If it's a sports story you're talking about, you can guarantee they'll be talking about it. Unless it's something like Arena Football. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Sportsnet Radio Network. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Mike Johnson. Coming up in the next couple hours, talk about the Maple Leafs bouncing back nicely from Tuesday's shellacking at the hands of the Los Angeles Kings. The Toronto Raptors continue to roll against teams not named the Cleveland Cavaliers. Another victory against one of the better teams in the Eastern Conference yesterday. It's DeMar DeRozan rolling through the NBA this season. He looks like a man on a mission. We'll also touch on UFC 205 tonight at Madison Square Garden. But, gents, let's start with the Toronto Blue Jays, who have dipped their toe into the free agent waters. Not Jose Bautista, not Edwin Encarnacion, but they've solidified, I suppose, the DH position for the next 3 years, signing Kendrys Morales for $33 million over those 3 years. We don't know exactly how the contract breaks down. In fact, it's not even official yet, but it seems like eventually this will come to pass and be official once everybody's passed the medicals. 3 years at $33 million. He's a switch hitter, and it likely means the end of Edwin Encarnacion's time as a Toronto Blue Jay. Mike, your initial reaction to the Kendrys Morales era starting in 2017?
I think it is exactly what the Blue Jays wanted. You know, ideally you bring back Edwin because right now he's a better player. He can bring you more offense, obviously. Just look at the numbers from last year. Him and David Ortiz, most RBIs in the AL. Okay, you want that player. You want those types of players on your team. But you don't want, you know, you want to be smart with your money. Every team does. You know, most teams don't have this unlimited budget. And that was a big factor in whether or not, you know, and I mean, there's still, I suppose, an outside chance that they bring Edwin back as like their first baseman. But I mean, the chances that seem is slim to none. So for, you know, if Edwin was your plan A and it looked unlikely, I think this is the perfect plan B. Because you want to add more left-handed bats. He still has power. He hit 30 home runs, and most of those came in the second half of the season. So in that sense, he's kind of trending upwards. He's a younger player than Edwin. And
barely.
A few years younger, though. You know, by the end...
A few months younger.
I thought he was a couple... He's not 30 years old?
No, he's 33.
Oh, so he's... Okay, he is the same age.
Edwin turns 34 in January. Kendrys turns 34 in June.
I was looking at his home runs. That's his home runs, not his age. My bad. But so, okay... You're going to end up paying him half the money per season, or approximately that.
At least half.
Yeah, but you're not going to get half the production. You're going to get more than half the production. I think it's realistic to anticipate a dip. He's probably not going to hit as many home runs. He's probably not going to get as many RBI, but he might make it easier in terms of how they set the lineup. Because he's a left-handed bat, it might make things easier on that sense. John Gibbons talked about that at the end of the season. He just outright said, I think it would have been better if we had a few more lefties in the lineup. And, you know, he's a DH, right? As long as he hits the ball, you don't have to worry about, you know, his body breaking down, really. I mean, unless he jumps on home plate too hard, I suppose.
Yeah, right.
But I think if you're looking at just... If Edwin was plan A, I think this is an ideal plan B for what was out there.
I mean, before we get into any downsides of this move, I think, yeah, he's also been playing in pitcher's parks for pretty much his entire career.
Yeah.
He was in KC, he was in Seattle, he was LA before that. So it's, yeah, like I don't even know if you really want to expect a dip because he's going to be playing in the friendly confines of the Rockies.
When I say a dip, I just mean a dip relative to Edwin's numbers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, not to his 30 home runs. I think that would be, you know, par for the course. If he does take a dip from his recent numbers, it'll be disappointing. I mean, what I meant to say was a dip relative to what Edwin produced this
year. Right, which is kind of a high bar, yeah. right? But yeah, I think the value you're going to get out of him is a little bit less too than half because of him not playing a defensive position.
Right.
Which I think, yeah, like it could present problems and sort of presents an issue sort of going forward. If you'd signed Edwin, you know, even though it would have been expensive, you could have sort of slotted him in for a lot of those first base games that you need to fill. So yeah, Morales isn't going to do that. You've got a full-time DH now. He does offer you that lefty bat, but you need to fill that spot now, and Justin Smoke isn't going to be the guy to do it.
Mm-hmm. I would hope not. Like, is there any scenario you guys see the Blue Jays going into opening day next season with Justin Smoke as the first baseman?
I mean, I don't see it as a good scenario, but I think it's a option. Like, it's like, I mean, it's sort of low down on like, okay, well, plan what, like Z5 is going with Justin Smoke. Because I think at this point,
we're in Canada, it's Z5.
I think going forward, you want a top line first baseman who can hit and, you know, who can defend the position and stuff like that. You know, both lefties and righties, I think he's, you know, that's your goal. But if that doesn't happen and you wind up with imperfect options, I think Smoke winds up being one of those imperfect options that you would really, really hope to avoid.
Yeah, but as you guys mentioned, Kendrys Morales is a DH, and that's all. I mean, yep. He can, I suppose, in a pinch, play defense at first base or left field. You'd cover your eyes if you saw him in the outfield for more than a game or two. And if you get to a World Series, I suppose, and he's hit well enough to deserve to be in the lineup on the road in an NL Park or an interleague, okay, that's a different scenario. But he's a DH primarily. He can barely move. So is it fair in assessing this? Because Shai Davidi has basically said that the writing on the wall means that there will not be a re-signing of Edwin Encarnacion, because as much as his defense is passable and sometimes good at first base, it's not an ideal scenario to play him every day at first base, and he would have to if he was re-signed to this team right now.
Yeah. I think it's tough from a Blue Jay fan perspective, because Edwin's been, you know, him and Batista, they've been fan favorites for years. They were acquired in ways you don't typically acquire players that end up being superstars. So it's tough for people to swallow the thought, especially after what he did in the playoffs and all the clutch home runs and stuff. But if you really look at it, just look at the numbers and look at it from a business perspective. At the beginning of the season, when Jose Bautista was asking for a crazy amount of money, a lot of fans were wanting the team to sign him to those numbers. Mm-hmm. But if you ask those fans who wanted them to sign Bautista to that, you know, $25, $30 million contract, ask them now, would you still make that deal? I'm sure most of them would say no. So the, you know, Edwin's numbers are great, but look at his age and just the history of most baseball players ever. Right. Those numbers, he's not going to be able to keep those numbers. You know, he won't be as productive as he was last season. So it's kind of a money ball situation. And also, if you were going to re-sign a star player like this, I mean, I get it's different. I'm more used to looking at hockey free agency and trade deadlines and stuff. I'm not sure how similar it is with baseball. But wouldn't you have already signed him to a long-term extension?
That's not fair, because hockey free agency is totally different. Agent frenzy. But that's not the way baseball works.
No, okay, I realize it's different. But I suppose they were talking throughout the season. Mm-hmm. But my thought is it's so risky. If this is a player that you know you want and you know you're willing to pay them a crazy amount of money, you get the deal done earlier, you don't even let it go to free agency, or you don't even let him have the type of season he did, because the way he played, he just raised his price.
Well, and I think the other difference between Major League Baseball and NHL free agency is you're dealing with the salary cap in the NHL, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're the best player, if you're an elite player, maybe there's a couple of million dollars to play with, but you generally know what you're going to get on the open market, and it's whatever, 12, 10, 12 million over 7 years. There's I'm sure, still a difference in opinion on what Edwin Encarnacion is going to get on the free agent market. Because, yeah, he can play first base, and like I said, pretty well, but he only played 70-some-odd games there last year. Do you want him as your full-time first baseman? Does that eliminate the National League for you? Is he a DH? He's going to be 34. Five-year deal for a 34-year-old DH at $25 million.
It's just risky. Just you saying that, that's just so risky. And you would have to think that he's going to get at least 20 no matter where he goes, right?
I figure.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he would be worth that in the long. He might be worth that right now, but I don't think realistically you can expect him to be the same player a few years down the line.
Well, I think should and probably was taken into account is payroll going forward and the understanding that, hey, any of these long-term contracts, because the list of them that have actually worked out for the length of the deal is so short. Mm-hmm. Like I was shocked at how quickly the Albert Pujols deal was not worth it.
No.
When you sign these deals, you have to understand the last couple of years, maybe the last 3 years, are an overpay for declining value. If you can stomach that, and if your payroll is large enough that you can still do things around $25 million of dead money, then, okay, maybe you're a little more open to it. But if you believe that, no, you can't do that, then it's not a risk worth taking, which I guess the Blue Jays have decided. They had a number. They did make a legitimate offer, apparently. I don't know if anybody's offering him the 25 over 5 that maybe he anticipated, and maybe that will come, but you figure if he was offered that, he would have accepted by now because people are starting to accept it.
And you got to expect that the Jays would have, they had that sort of team-only opportunity to negotiate.
Yeah.
That's the time you fire your best shot, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, you don't want him to go to the market to find out, someone's going to throw $30 million at you, you know. Yeah, you don't want that. You want to give him an opportunity to say, this is more money than I ever thought I was going to make. I'm just going to take this deal. I'm going to end the speculation right now. If they didn't do it then it really seems sort of unlikely that they were going to sort of, we found out we have all this extra money to throw at you. Everything's great. I guess the only other thought there would be that he just didn't get the offer at all that he thought he was going to get. And then you wind up...
It's still early, though.
It is still early. It is funny the way that free agency periods work in the different sports. You know, in NBA, you've got, $100 million spent on one guy before like 12:01 a.m., kind of thing.
Baseball, some guys go almost to when pitchers and catchers report in February.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't see that in the NBA. You don't see it a whole lot in the NHL. Yeah, and in MLB, it's just such a longer process. It makes me so nerve-wracking
for
these
guys. There's no free agent frenzy the way there is in basketball or hockey.
Yeah. Which is a shame for baseball writers because they got to be like on the clock. Basically,
I'm sure there are a lot of people did. It's like, free agency. They see R.A. Dickey signing, and free agency's open. It's kind of like sneaks up on you because it doesn't happen right away.
No.
Yeah.
Let's talk about R.A. Dickey, who signed with the Atlanta Braves, who locked up about 80 some odd years of pitching over the last few days. Signs with the Atlanta Braves and goes back to the National League. It's a one-year deal with a club option for a second year. So a multi-year deal for a guy who's 40 years old, knuckleballer, had some great success, of course, winning a Cy Young Award with the New York Mets in that same division, the National League East. Let's maybe reminisce about his time in Toronto. Of course, the expectation was that he would be, he started opening day, right, when he arrived. He was coming off a Cy Young Award season. I think there was an expectation of some dip in performance, maybe not to the degree at which he dipped, but he was still, I think, an underrated contributor to this Blue Jays team. And if somebody goes down next season, those 200 innings are going to be missed.
Yeah, well, I think, right, that's the thing. You look at his record, you look at the numbers, they're less than stellar, but it's the innings. Knuckleballers don't get hurt the way other pitchers get hurt. They can go, their shelf life is much longer than your average pitcher. And it's the innings more than the production that the team might miss if they run into injury problems, just like what you said. Looking back on R.A. Dickey's time in Toronto. I don't know how you can look at a guy like that and just not be a fan of R.A. Dickey.
I think the guy he was traded for turned into Noah Syndergaard. Yeah. Right?
I mean, there's always going to be.
I mean, it was always Noah Syndergaard, but he turned into one of the best pitchers in the major leagues.
It's true. And I mean, every time R.A. Dickey had a poor outing, you would see people talking about Syndergaard on Twitter. Like, it didn't matter what time of the year it was. It didn't matter if Syndergaard was even playing that night as well. And, you know, if a player's traded for another player, you're always going to compare them. You know, if a team makes a trade and a draft pick that they traded turns into a superstar, you're going to be like, oh, man, they traded away the pick that turned into. Well, it's like you don't know what that pick's going to turn into. And the Jays, you know, I don't know if you knew Noah Syndergaard was going to be quite as good as he has turned out to be. It makes it look bad in hindsight, that deal. But I was a fan of R.A. Dickey and the way he presented himself. You know, you see a lot of, he's kind of the polar opposite to a Marcus Stroman, in the sense that he can calm everything down. He can slow a game down where other pitchers, like, they ramp it up and they're high energy. I think that's just my personality. I'm not a high energy person. I'm a calm, let's just have a conversation about this, man. And R.A. Dickey was
You're
that
pacifist.
I would say so. We both have beards, so there you go. More in common. I like R.A. Dickey, but from a baseball perspective, it's the innings. You know, he could put up a very similar stat line with Atlanta that he did with Toronto this year, and it'll be potentially worth his $7.58 million that he's going to make. It's a lot of guaranteed money for someone in their 40s, but it's kind of a low risk if you're willing to eat that money.
Yeah, and the National League is where you go if you're a 42-year-old knuckleballer.
Yeah.
Because more than 10% of the batters you face are going to be the other team's pitcher, which is good. 1019, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Sportsnet Radio Network. It's Sportsnet Magazine Live. Ben Ennis, Mike Johnson, Craig Battle. So the Blue Jays, with another move yesterday, signed two Cubans, actually. So the Blue Jays kind of controlling the Cuban market early on. Mm-hmm. And it was a move that now goes under the radar with the signing of Kendrys Morales, of course. But before that, they signed Lourdes Gurriel Jr., whose father, Lourdes Gurriel, apparently a massive star in Cuba, can't walk down the street without getting mobbed. But this is a kid whose brother, Yulieski Gurriel, was signed by the Houston Astros last year, had a cup of coffee in the major leagues. This year, there's questions about how well that bat will play in the major leagues, but he plays or has played all four infield positions, played a little left field as well. He's on a 7-year deal at $22 million, and he's 23, so not subject to international spending caps, but a guy that you have to give $22 million to, and there's not a guarantee of him ever even playing in the major leagues.
I think it looks like a nice sort of low risk, high reward move. Like, he's 23 years old. He'll start the season in Double A. Very real possibility. He plays a little bit with the Jays next year. He's sort of positionally versatile. And he projects as a plus player in a lot of ways, right? Like, a lot of, you know, just sort of in the quick reading I was doing yesterday, sort of, he was the sixth ranked.
International free agent available.
Exactly. Sixth ranked international free agent available. You're getting him for $3 million a year about. And a lot of people were saying that, you know, like, you could have ranked him a lot higher than that because of his readiness. And that's exactly what the Jays need at this point. They're not looking for the next window, you know, like, although he will be around for, they're looking for a guy who could potentially contribute to this team while, you know, Josh Donaldson is still here and Aaron Sanchez is doing great and Marcus Stroman and whatnot, right? So you're looking at a guy who, at the very least, in, say, 2018, could be a major contributor to your team. And he, as a 21-year-old in the Cuban professional leagues, he tore it up. He was a 344 hitter, 967 OPS. And, yeah, like, obviously that's not exactly major league pitching, but it's not nothing. Like, he's a good prospect, and he's potentially ready to contribute a little bit.
Is this an example as well? Because we heard going into this offseason, Shai Davidi's written about it, and nobody's been upfront about the actual number as far as payroll the Blue Jays will have in 2017. But this seems like another opportunity where the Blue Jays have taken it to outspend other teams, to use their financial clout to cover up some weaknesses, because we still know, while the cupboard's not entirely bare in the minor leagues, it's not what it once was, of course, after the spending spree a couple of years ago of Alex Anthopoulos. Is an opportunity. It's just money. It's all it's costing you, $22 million, and it's a lottery ticket. It's a lot of money to throw out the door if he never makes the major leagues or is not an impact player at the major league level. But if you're a team with the financial wherewithal of the Toronto Blue Jays or the way they should operate, this is a risk worth taking and seemingly a good one to build your system.
I would agree. Just, you know, you look at the attendance and the TV ratings, and it was a good year for the Toronto Blue Jays. They didn't win at all, but it was another successful year. So there's no reason why they shouldn't keep investing into the team. You know when the team does well, it's an incredible investment for the ownership. So, and that's why, you know, that's why some, like, not signing Edwin, I don't think it's as big a deal, because, you know, if, hypothetically, if they were to sign him to around 20 mil, okay, you replace that with 11 million with Morales, it doesn't mean you're, like, now there's $9 million that a team who it appears that they're willing to spend that $9 million. So you look and you go, okay, well, they can actually do something. They're not just making this signing to save money. They're actually going to do something with the money they would have spent on Edwin. And that should, in theory, make your team much better, much deeper, much more well-rounded. With this prospect, I don't know nothing about this guy. 7 years, $22 million for a guy who's never played in the majors. I have no idea if it's going to work out. Like, it really is a gamble, but they feel strongly, if you feel strongly enough to give a guy like that a 7-year contract, that's, I think that speaks volumes to his potential. And it's refreshing to look at the Blue Jays line prospects, guys like Guerrero and Alford, and just kind of like exciting names, like they're really high ceiling prospects, and in years past we haven't seen that. And so that's my takeaway from it. All right, if you have the money, like you said, spend it, take a gamble. It could turn out to be an incredible investment.
Yeah, and you also need to replace sort of the fanfare and the interest in Edwin Encarnacion with something else, right? Like, you can't just go, okay, he's gone now, and then we're just going to be the same team with the same sort of depleted farm system and stuff like that, and we hope that people come out. Like, you need to give the fan base something to look forward to, something to talk about, something to take away from this free agency period. Because obviously that's not the way a lot of teams sort of want to build moving forward. Free agency isn't the way you sort of go about, putting together a championship ball club.
No,
it's also a way you can lose a championship ball club by losing everybody in free agency and just not replacing it with anything. So this seems to me like, okay, so Kendrys Morales is your move to just sort of replace his production as well as you possibly can for next season. And then you need to do something moving forward. You need to get people talking, and you need to sort of at least take a big swing, like shoot for the fences, et cetera.
Yeah, there's little question that the Blue Jays right now are worse than they were in 2016 or 2017, especially that position, because Kendrys Morales is a worse offensive player than Edwin Encarnacion. He's not a bad offensive player, but Edwin's an elite one, and Morales is not. You throw Joey Votto at first base, changes everything.
Yeah,
nobody wants to follow me down that path.
Well, I'll follow you. I'll get Joey Votto in a total vacuum. Like, let's do it in a second.
Well, and that's, I mean, you talk about throwing around your cash.
Yeah,
if you've got it. I mean, that would be a move like that. Although the Reds seemingly are backing off any thought of ever trading him. But a lot of people say a lot of stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, it's possible that they're just sort of garnering interest in the way that they're saying that they're not going to just give them away for, you know, taking someone taking on the money, you know, but maybe they're just sort of looking for players or whatever. Like, I mean, I don't know what the Reds would want for that guy at this point, considering how little he can do to affect their wins and losses. The team is not built well around him.
Yeah.
So now would seem like a fine time to see what you can get for him. If they're not thinking that, then really that's not a very intelligent run ball club. But if you're the Blue Jays and you have an opportunity, you're on the phone with the Reds, you have to see what he could do for you, because he is the perfect fit, both from an on-field standpoint and from a fan interest standpoint.
Yeah, he's just a great player all the way around, and he is a guy that can play every day at first base because that's what he does, because he plays in the National League. When we come back, Maple Leafs beat the Flyers 6-3 yesterday, which was a rather large win considering how Tuesday went. 7-0 beat down at the hands of the Los Angeles Kings at the Air Canada Center. Talk about the bounce back for the Maple Leafs. Yeah, maybe compare Austin Matthews to Patrick Laine if we feel inclined. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Mike Johnson. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's on Sportsnet.ca right now, here's Dan Robson.
We played a lot of backgammon, Pocklington and I.
We used to bet a little bit.
They didn't like each other. They were always trying to outdo each other.
And he says, let's play backgammon for Wayne.
If Nelson loses, Edmonton gets Wayne.
I'm not sure how true that backgammon game is, but I know somewhere, somehow, there was something involved.
Peter, being a gambler, he took the challenge.
He put everything on one roll of the dice.
That might be a myth. That might be a legend. I'd like to hear what the real story is.
Is it possible that the greatest hockey player of all time was traded because of a backgammon wager? The story of how Wayne Gretzky was almost a Winnipeg Jet has passed through hockey lore for decades. It's twisted and turned in retellings, morphing into one of those tales that seems just too good to be true. That the great one was lost in a board game while he sat on a plane, uncertain of whether it was going to land in Edmonton or Winnipeg. It's a story that could only emerge from the late 1970s as the upstart World Hockey Association clashed with the old boys club that was the NHL. It was a time when rich owners paid debts with luxury cars and rare art. Pro contracts were drawn up by hand and signed without lawyers. Underage hockey stars were offered exorbitant sums to spurn the NHL and play in cities that had zero interest in the game. And yes, some owners were even willing to gamble the fate of their franchises over a game of backgammon. It was the Wild West of hockey, and because of it, Edmonton became a dynasty, while Winnipeg sputtered and failed.
Fans can find this story and more on Sportsnet.ca. Canada's home for sports news, analysis, videos, and features. Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. No medical exam or health questions will be asked. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Mike Johnson. Toronto Maple Leafs had their poorest performance of the season on Tuesday in a 7-0 shellacking to the hands of the Los Angeles Kings. Yesterday was their first game back in action, and it was a good one. Battled back a couple of times, including in the third period to beat the Philadelphia Flyers, who, by the way, have allowed the most goals against in the Eastern Conference. And you can see why. Leafs beat them 6-3. Steve Mason wasn't all that good, but kudos to the Maple Leafs for bouncing back with that victory. So they're now, I don't know, 500-ish? Do you want to, I don't know how you define 500 in the NHL anymore, but 6-6-3 is where the Maple Leafs stand. A bunch of firsts yesterday. Zach Hyman, his first of the season. Leo Komarov, Martin Marincin, Morgan Riley, all with their first goals of the season. I think everybody's still trying to get their arms around what exactly the Leafs are this year, despite, or one thing we're sure of, they're way more entertaining than they were in 2015, 2016. But Craig, what are the Leafs this year? And was yesterday's win more than just 2 points, just a good indicator for this team?
I mean, I think it's a good indicator. It's a nice sign that they can bounce back from a 7-0 loss couple of nights before, which shows the resilience of this team, which shows the fact that they can get their heads back on after losing, and they're not going to fall into a funk. They're not going to go down the same sort of path that they would have in the past or other bad teams do. But at the same point, like, this is a team that's going to be up and down all season. I don't think there's going to be a, hey, you know, like, this has been a reasonably nice patch of play for this team. It's going to be like, yeah, they're either on a hot streak or they're on a cold streak, and I don't think it's going to change. Like, they're the team that has won four of their last five, won an OT, and they're also the team that lost 7-0 one night. Mm-hmm. Like, that's going to happen. It's a team on the rise, absolutely, but they're going to play bad games and they're going to have rough moments.
And I think if you look at their blowout loss, the next day what happened? Mike Babcock, he skated them into the ground. It was the hardest practice they've had all season. And it was like to teach them a lesson. It's like, all right, guys, if you're going to play like that, this is what's going to happen. And so there's motivation there. And Mike Babcock knows what he's doing from a player motivation standpoint, that a performance against the Kings, it's unacceptable. And you saw how they were skating hard. It didn't look great early in the game against the Flyers, but man, they kept skating. Like they were, it wasn't going to end up the way the previous game went, because I'm sure in the back of their mind going, I don't want to do bag skates anymore during the season. You know, it's things like that. It really was a good bounce back win coming off a poor game and then coming off kind of an iffy start against the Flyers.
But it's also a testament to their sort of like youthful exuberance and talent, mm-hmm. and attitude, that they didn't play like that. They didn't play like they were terrified of having a bag skate the next day. Like they were excited. They were scoring goals and they were getting up for it and they were... And like you said, they had a bad start. So it's like you could see a team sort of like, oh, geez, you know, like another bag skate on the way, you know, like let's just try not to screw this up too badly.
Yeah.
But they went after it and they scored some goals and they had some fun. Like it was one of the takeaways, one of the positive signs for this team is how much fun they seem to be having.
Oh man.
Which is fantastic, both as a fan and for the team itself.
Even if you compare it to a team a few years ago in the shortened season when the Leafs, they had a decent team, they made the playoffs, they had some good players. Kessel, Bozak, JVR was one of the best lines in the league. But even like when they would score a big goal, like maybe Mikhail Grabowski would kind of jump on the glass and stuff, but it wasn't like the legitimate youthful exuberance, like you said, that this team has. It's such a completely different team. Yes, it's mostly new players, but just the energy around the Leafs this year, it's so refreshing. If you know the guys, the players were making fun of Mitch Marner for his little dance. I forget whose goal it was, but Mitch Marner, his celebration was just, he's hopping on the ice like he's an 11-year-old. And some of the Leafs look like they're in high school still, and they have that energy, and it's great. And, you know, we saw that a little bit in the World Cup of Hockey with Team North America.
Right.
And this just new wave of players, the Leafs have a bunch of those players, mm-hmm. and you're really seeing that, and with that comes, you know, defensive lapses. With that comes, you know, there's a big learning curve to playing against NHLers every single night. But if you just look at the standings in the East, there's no reason, especially if the Leafs get good goaltending, which they have been recently for the most part from Freddie Anderson. There's no reason why they couldn't compete with the Detroits of the world, with the New Jersey Devils of the world, to make a push for a wild card spot.
Well, should that be the goal then? Because it's clearly not finishing 30th. It's not getting the most ping pong balls and a chance to draft number one overall. Of course, that wouldn't be the worst thing in the world, I suppose, for this team's development. And I don't think anybody has any illusions about this team winning a Stanley Cup. But, I mean, you make the playoffs, anything can happen. But should that be a legitimate goal for this team now, is compete for a playoff spot and earn one of those playoff spots? Because you mentioned that, there's some elite teams at the top of the Eastern Conference. The mm-hmm. Rangers seem legit. The Canadiens with Carey Price seem near unbeatable. There's
Tampa,
the Lightning.
Washington still good, yeah.
Yeah, Pittsburgh. They're not in that class, but is there anybody going to sit here and say that they're any worse than those other teams that'll be competing for a wild card spot in the Eastern Conference?
No, if they get the goaltending, then there's no reason why they shouldn't.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, sort of, there's way too much talent. There's way too much coaching. So barring a catastrophic injury or catastrophic injuries, this team isn't going to bottom out the way last year's team did, or the way that the Canucks are now. Like, it's sort of, they're not that team. They're not finishing 30th and they're not, winning the lottery kind of thing, get the next number one pick. So why, in that case, why would you want to be the, you know, like the 14th pick in the draft versus the 15th pick in the draft? Like, you know, it's not going to hurt you moving forward in your draft position. So it's like, yeah, let's go for it. I'm not saying you want to make one of the sort of knee-jerk, short-term gain moves that the Leafs have been lambasted for in the past, but you certainly want to be gunning for it. And as a fan, I don't think it's outlandish to think that that's possible.
And it's also, it's not all roses, you know, like the forwards are getting the bulk of the attention, and for good reason. That's where all the high draft picks in recent years have gone, outside of Morgan Rielly. Mm-hmm. But you know, they really do need to tighten up on defense. Their blue line is not one of the better blue lines in the NHL.
It's a bad blue line.
It's right. You know, they do have good pieces. Zaitsev looks like a really good player, and sure. Morgan Rielly, if he, you know, reaches his ceiling, could. Hey, I mean, I've always
a 4-point game yesterday.
And there you go. And if he keeps up that pace, he'll set some records. But like, if he could, to me, his ceiling's like a guy like a Duncan Keith. Like, Morgan Rielly's that good. If he lives up to his potential, you build around him, and all of a sudden, you know, maybe next season or even later this season, with a move here and there, they actually have a good blue line. And you know, they've been allowing a lot more shots on goal in recent games, and that's probably never a good sign. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they still need, for all the positive you see up front, they still need to tighten things up on defense. And early in the season, when Freddie Anderson was struggling, he was allowing goals he probably shouldn't have, but a lot of the goals weren't his fault. You know, it was a result of poor defensive play. Mm-hmm. So if right. you know, goaltending is going to be important, and if they can get good goaltending, it'll help them. But what will help their goaltending is playing a more structured defensive style. And that's what Mike Babcock, you know, he has a history of his teams playing a 200-foot games, and it's still early with this group of Leafs, so we're going to see that. But right now, there's no reason to think that this is another tanking season. Once you've got Austin Matthews, once you got the first overall pick and a player like that you can build around, and now you look at their top nine forwards, and it's like, well, you know what? Those are three good hockey lines. They really are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you can't – and Mike Babcock's not the type of person that is going to want to miss the playoffs. He's not accustomed to that. He wins everywhere he goes. And even last year, he wanted to win – everyone wants to win every game. It goes without saying, but – there's no reason this year why they couldn't compete for a playoff spot, considering the other teams in the East outside of the top four or five.
Yeah, and I mean, there is that sort of that mushy middle section. You know, you got Ottawa, New Jersey, Detroit's in there, Boston. I don't think you want to be counting your chickens before they've hatched or anything like that. Like,
no.
I don't think that sort of it's a, okay, yeah, like we're odds on favorites to be eighth or, you know, whatever. They're in ninth or tenth right now. But yeah, I think that as a fan, you can sort of like, you know, put your expectation up a tiny bit, you know, from where it might have been at the beginning of the season.
Yeah, which is, I mean, you're talking about a team coming off a season in which they finished 30th in the NHL.
So exactly.
Yes, the bar is set a little bit higher than 30th.
Sure.
So I teased this going into the last break, and I've been facetious about it when I've talked about it. It's not the first time I've talked about it on the radio, that Austin Matthews went first overall. And, of course, he had the 4-goal game to set the bar so super high for himself right out of the gates against the Ottawa Senators. He's in a bit of a goal-scoring slump. He hasn't scored one in, what, 7-8 games now? And the guy that went second overall leads the NHL in goal-scoring, Patrick Laine, and his linemate Mark Scheifele is right there as well, just mm-hmm. 1 goal back of him with 10. There's no one that's a legitimate hockey person that's making the argument yet, and maybe they never will, and I don't know if the odds have changed, that Laine should have gone first overall, that the Maple Leafs should have drafted him first overall. Is there anybody making that argument?
Well, people who love knee-jerk reactions are, and people who don't think things through, they'll be making that argument. I'm sure they've already made that argument. I'm sure they made that argument on draft night. We should have took Laine, you know? You know, if you just see...
But there, it's one thing to project the number of goals he's going to score.
Oh, yeah, no,
the NHL,
he's
you know, scoring now.
Right away.
Hat tricks.
Yeah, and especially if you're a Leafs fan, you know, the hat trick he scored against you, it's like, oh, man, that's what we could have had.
After leading 4-0.
Yeah, but, I mean, obviously, Taylor Hall and Tyler Seguin are still compared to one another because they went 1-2 and they were, you know, relatively close on you know, the scouts' consensus, you know, where and as to where they're ranked. But they're so, the Matthews and Laine are such different players. One's a 200 foot center, and the other is, you know, like
Bill Kessel.
I was going to say Alex Ovechkin. You know, very similar player to Alex Ovechkin. Whereas Austin Matthews should be an Anze Kopitar, a Jonathan Toews, a point per game or around that mark type player, but brings you, you know, key face-offs, and he can go up against the other team's top line on a nightly basis and the other team's top D pairing and all that. Whereas Laine, and also Laine has a lot more pieces to work with right now in Winnipeg.
Yeah, his team is better.
He's on a better team. Right. They're just different players. Like, it doesn't mean one's necessarily more valuable than the other, because if all you look at is goal scoring, then that's not how you watch hockey. You
sure.
know? It's not all about the stat line.
Right. And if there can be a downside to a four-goal debut historic showing by Austin Matthews, it's that I think people got an idea from that not like he was going to score four goals a game all season, but that he was maybe more of a goal scorer, more of an elite goal scorer than he actually is. So then you've got this period where he misses a few games, goals. He's got on a little goal streak. That people start worrying, like, oh, well, is he falling apart? Why isn't he scoring goals all the time? You know, that's not the player that he was supposed to be. That's not the player that the Leafs drafted. They knew Laine was going to score more goals.
Yeah, and they needed that number one centerman, which I imagine they still believe Austin Matthews can be. When we come back, Raptors now with 5 wins in their last 6 games as they beat the Charlotte Hornets yesterday on the road, 113-111. Another game in which DeMar DeRozan scored 30-plus points. He's only failed to do that once this season. How good are the Raptors, and can DeMar DeRozan possibly keep this up for 82 games this season? We'll discuss next. Ben Ennis, Craig Battle, Mike Johnston at Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Subscribe to our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Do not settle. Demand. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. The top topics. The headiest headlines. The debatiest debate. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Don't pop, Molly, I rock time for. International, bring back the Concord. Numbers don't lie. Check the scoreboard.
11:02, Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Sportsnet Radio Network. Ben Ennis alongside Craig Battle and Mike Johnson until 12 o'clock this afternoon. The Toronto Raptors are good. We knew this. They were 6 wins away from winning it all last year. That was unlikely. But they took 2 against the champs in the Eastern Conference Final. The Cleveland Cavaliers is one of the 2 teams that have beaten the Raptors this year. Of course, loss at home to the Sacramento Kings as well, and a bit of a surprising result a couple of Sundays ago. But yesterday, they go into Charlotte, play a Hornets team that was just behind the Cavaliers in the Eastern Conference race atop the standings. They had only 1 loss, and the Raptors handed them their 2nd on the road in Charlotte, a place that the Raptors do not win.
No.
Except they did yesterday, beat them 113-111. It was back and forth. This is actually a rather entertaining game on Sportsnet 1. Raptors were down early. There was an 18-0 run. The Hornets gave them the lead, and the Raptors bouncing back in that second half and in the fourth quarter specifically. DeMar DeRozan was outstanding. Once again, he was 14-26 shooting for 34 points. Just once this season, he's failed to score 30 points in a ball game. He is obviously still offended that ESPN ranked him in the low 40s.
Right.
Can he keep doing this, Craig?
Well, I mean, on a level, I think the answer is yes. I mean, the fact that he's been improving year to year is no surprise. The fact that he's always been a total gym rat, that he doesn't care about anything else but his family and basketball. He was always going to keep improving even after he got the money. You know, that's the worry with anybody else generally. It's like, oh, well, got paid and now he's locked up. He's made his $100 million. Is he going to try as hard? And I think nobody was worried about that with DeMar.
Yeah.
So, and he's also, he's improved every year of his career in a lot of different ways. His handle has improved. His passing has improved. His shot making, you know, his post moves, his sort of like deep, like out post moves as well. So yeah, like the fact that he's playing incredibly well, he's going to keep up a high level of play, and he's going to be sort of another all-star campaign for him, I'm pretty sure. Can he keep up exactly the level? Like, can he shoot 54% for the rest of the season? Can you lead the league in scoring? I think he's going to regress a little bit. Like, we saw it against Sacramento where, you know, he shot 7-20. Ball wasn't falling for him. The team lost as an effect of that.
So that was one out of eight this year, though.
It's one out of eight. So, yeah, no, I'm saying he's going to have other bad games. And I think he's going to have a non-great shooting game. And even in that game, he's still got 23 points. Even when he has a game where he shoots 7 of 20, he's a valuable player in a lot of ways because he's getting to the line. He's seeing open spots. He's getting nice passes. He's, you know, doing like, he's not ball hawking like crazy. It's not like he's a Carmelo Anthony type ball stopper. The team doesn't have a lot of ball movement, but DeMar DeRozan does have nice little handoff passes and stuff like that that he does at this point. He will look to Kyle Lowry if Kyle Lowry's hot, that kind of thing. He will keep up a really high level of play. I don't think we're going to see a jump from 23.5 points last season to 34 points per game this season. That seems like he's going to regress to the mean in a couple of ways, but I still think this is going to be an uptick from last season.
Yeah, it's 34 points a game is unsustainable in today's NBA for the course of a season. But, you know, so expect that to take a dip. But even if he's averaging at the end of the season high 20s, 28, 29 points, I mean, that's fantastic. That's mm-hmm. that's not something I don't think a lot of people would have predicted that out of DeMar. And last couple playoffs, I've been one of the people saying I don't think DeMar DeRozan is the type of franchise player. I don't think he's him and Lowry are the duo that can lead a team to an East final or an NBA finals. But you know, so far, and I know I wasn't alone in that thought.
No,
and I know a guy like DeMar DeRozan, he's aware that people are saying that about him. And so if that, you know, led to him really focusing and making the improvements, the adjustments he needed to make in the offseason, I think we're seeing, you know, the fruits of his labor so far this season. But like you mentioned, Craig, the Raptors don't have to just rely on him. They have, and if they do have to rely on him, it's not a good situation to be in. You know,
wouldn't you say though, this year they have pretty much relied on him? That the scoring has not exactly been all that spread. I mean, you've had guys go off on occasion. I mean, Terrence Ross has had some pretty good shooting games. Mm-hmm. Kyle Lowry hasn't really had that explosive offensive game yet this season. But offensively, what do the Raptors have outside? And Jonas Valanciunas is banged up now, I understand.
Sure.
But that he is their offense, right?
I mean, right now, absolutely. Like, Kyle Lowry has not had a great start to the season. So, like, the type of jump that DeMar has made, Lowry's stats and sort of, like, the efficiency have taken a step back just about the same. So, to me, that's a good sign for them moving forward. If DeMar has a bit of a tailing off, even if it's to, like a high 20s, because he certainly seems like he's balling, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kyle Lowry is going to return to normal Kyle Lowry form. So, yeah, for me, those two, yeah, they're definitely solidifying themselves. It's one of the best backcourts in the NBA. They really work well together. And that's no worries for me. Like, they're great. They're going to be awesome throughout the rest of the season. Yeah, and where it gets sort of sketchy for me is what they're getting out of Damari Carroll and the power forward position. Because right now, Damari Carroll is still banged up, doesn't quite look like himself. He had a nice shooting night against OKC, but again, last night he wasn't much of a factor on the offense beyond a couple of layups and a couple of short jumpers. He's not hitting his three generally very well. The power forward spot, you're not getting a lot of spacing when you have Pascal Siakam in the game. He's showing a lot. He's, you know, he's a 27th pick rookie. He's, you know, definitely outplaying that right now, but he's not a perfect fit for those guys. He's not a perfect fit in SJV. And if Damari Carroll isn't getting the respect of a guy who can hit three-pointers, then you're putting a lot of onus on DeMar and Kyle Lowry. And we've talked about that in seasons past, where, sure, those guys are the engine of the team. great. Like, they're great players. They can do a lot of things consistently, but you don't want them playing 38 plus minutes a game like they're playing right now.
Yeah.
That's a recipe for massive burnout. So you want to rely on JV more, and then now he's injured. So now it's like you've got no choice but to completely grind with DeMar and Kyle. And I think that's, yeah, not great moving forward. But JV, I think when he is in the game and when he is healthy, he's showing the type of improvement that he showed last playoffs, where you can rely on him and you can go to him, and his efficiency numbers are fantastic. Lucas Nogueira is giving you excellent backup minutes at center, which was always the hope but never assured.
No, and it was looking more and more like Jakob Poeltl would be the guy picking up those minutes mm-hmm. when Jonas Valanciunas was unavailable, or you went to your second big off the bench, and all of a sudden he's a DNP CD because Nogueira, after starting the season injured and not playing because he was unable to physically, now that he's back in playing shape, he's shown himself to be the guy that, I don't know, like, what was your ceiling for Bebe Nogueira? Is it about where he's played the last couple of games?
I think there's certain things that he's doing that are taking points off the board. He's extending his arms. He's getting rebound positioning, but he's not actually pulling the ball down. They gave up a lot of offensive rebounds to the Hornets on Friday. So I think he can be an even better rebounder. I think his rim protection is about as good as you're going to get. He's averaging almost 2 blocks a game in limited minutes, like 25 minutes a game, which is great. And that's sort of one of the questions with Bismack Biyombo moving on, who was going to be a rim protector. And Nogueira isn't the same type of guy. He's not like a vicious help side defender in the same way that Biyombo is, but he's got crazy long arms and affects shots.
And there's I don't know if there's a tangible anything you can attach to this, but when Bismack Biyombo was on the floor, you felt an energy level surge with this team that you get. I don't know if it's exactly the same with Bebe, but it does. Something feels different when Bebe's on the floor.
He's active, and I think he's like we talked about exuberance and the tone of the Maple Leafs, and I think that's sort of the thing that Nogueira can bring to the game, and the thing that Bismack definitely did. And we had conversations in the offseason. It's like, oh well, yeah, Bismack wasn't quite the player that he got made out to be because of a nice few games in the playoffs.
They were comparing him to Ben Wallace.
Yeah, exactly.
Hyperbole.
He's not Ben Wallace. Like, he wasn't NBA Defensive Player of the Year last year. He was a really nice piece and but a fantastic attitude, and like someone that you could look to who was impervious to other teams' intimidation, and a guy who always had a smile on his face and was going hard. Like, yeah, like a reckless smile. Like, I'm gonna go out and I'm gonna do this, get on my back kind of thing. And Nogueira, he has the same kind of smiley sort of imperviousness, but he also does know how to play the game. It was never a question like, does he have the talent? Because he's super long. Like, in practice, he shoots jumpers, you know, like he's he generally has a lot going for him, but it was sort of in that, can he put it together and can he play as well as he plays in the D League against NBA players? And I think you're seeing a lot of that now. And I think there is still room for him to improve just as he gets more comfortable on the floor.
So where are you with the three position? Because it was something we discussed before the season started, that our eyebrows were raised when Damari Carroll said he still was not at 100% after an entire offseason to recuperate. You wonder if that will ever happen. Will he ever be back to the player that he once was, that he showed for very brief flashes when he was first signed by the Raptors before he was injured last season? The three-point shooting has been very erratic. The offensive game has been very erratic. I don't even know if that's the primary reason he's a Toronto Raptor. It's the defense. It's the lockdown D, but that seemingly has taken a bit of a hit as well with maybe age and injury factors. Like, do you see a point at which his minutes continue to diminish, and can you play Norm Powell at that position, a couple inches shorter than Damari Carroll? Like, what happens the future of the three with this Raptors team?
The future of the three, I'm not sure if they have that sorted out yet. They've determined that Terrence Ross is not a starting three, even if they wanted to sort of have Damari Carroll rest a little bit, if that was sort of their thinking. I'm not sure why that wasn't a conversation in the offseason. Like, why are we bringing Damari Carroll back if he himself says he's still not 100%? Because the likelihood of being 100% when you need him in May and June, if he doesn't even start the season that way, is just nil. And he is an important player, like that 3-and-D player at 6'8", who can check the LeBron Jameses and the Nicholas Batums and stuff of the world at his peak, is so necessary. But last night against Nicholas Batum, he didn't show out well. Nicholas Batum was very active, both on the score sheet and, you know, sort of on the glass. And he didn't shut him down. And that's not, you know, an absolute world beater. We're not talking about an all-star exactly. So, yeah, like the last two games have looked good for Damari Carroll in terms of his shooting percentages. But before that, he was, you know, very shaky, didn't make a lot of impact in the way that you want to see him do on the offensive end. And he's still only playing 20 so or so minutes. So he's not able to be your shutdown guy if you can't play him big, like a lot of time in the game. So, yeah, I think that short term, you're still, the jury's out. Can Damari Carroll play himself into shape? And can he be like a 30-minute guy going forward? Is a question that the Raptors are going to continue asking. I think Norman Powell can play. If they were to do that, I think Norman Powell is your obvious starter at small forward. He gives up inches, but he's quick. He's tenacious. He seems to have the energy level and the motor to play that sort of role and to attack other teams, starting swingmen on the defensive end. And I think that's sort of something that he showed tail end of last season and at certain points in the playoffs, that the energy brings is very important and could function pretty well on the offensive end, starting the game.
11:16, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Sportsnet Radio Network, Sportsnet Magazine Live, Ben Ennis, Craig Battle, and Mike Johnston. So what's this team's biggest need as we go forward towards the trade deadline? I mean, it's so early. They played 8 games. But you figure this is not going to be the year, because we've seen it time and time again that Masai Ujiri's stood pat with his team. There are, I think, some pretty clear needs for this team, despite the fact they're very good. They're very good, right? Like when...
Right.
You're talking about one percenter problems with the Toronto Raptors. They were in an Eastern Conference final, and they won 2 games, went to a game 6 against the Cleveland Cavaliers. They're the worst team in the NBA shooting the 3. Right. They cannot shoot the 3.
No.
They've had one good shooting game from 3-point this season. That's it, one. Yeah. And like I said, they're the worst team in makes and percentage from the 3-point line in the NBA. Is that something you can improve upon by the trade market? Because it's unlikely... While there's some guys shooting below their career averages, even if they get to those, that's not particularly incredible. How much does that change the ceiling for this team if they're able to add a guy that can really space the floor shooting the 3 at a high percentage?
I think Jared Sullinger was supposed to do that a little bit, and that was a nice move that everybody saw. Is okay, well, he can be a starting power forward, and Patrick Patterson plays behind you. And, you know, if Patrick Patterson isn't necessarily feeling it in a game, then maybe you can play each other off. So, you know, Sullinger plays a little bit more this game, or, you know, Patrick Patterson is feeling it, so then you extend his minutes. But right now, Patrick Patterson is the only big that you have who can stretch the floor at all, and he's had some early season shooting woes, right? So that's a situation where if it's available, if you find that player on the trade block, then you have to try to pick him up, because again, you're facing an offseason where you might lose Kyle Lowry. You know, all indications are, just like with DeMar, that Kyle Lowry wants to come back, but there's always the possibility that you lose him, and that would be a massive hit for this team. If they came in next year without Kyle Lowry and they were playing Corey Joseph or DeLon Wright as your number one point guard, you're going to take a major step back. So this is still we're in win now mode. Let's see what we can do. But when you looked at it last year at the trade deadline, the guys they were looking at weren't better floor spacers than the guys they already had. They weren't long-term fits. They would have been short-term rentals for, you know, and you'd have to give up something for those guys. Nobody in the NBA is trading anything anymore for nothing. It's like, you know, like you're not going to get a lot, and you don't have a lot of like expiring contract type players that you're going to use for that type of deal.
You have like the Raps, they have a surplus of big bodies and like young big bodies. So maybe, you know, if they truly felt as the trade deadline approaches that a legitimate 3-point shooter who's available, if that's going to put you over the top, then maybe you have to give up in addition to a draft pick,
right,
you know, one of the young big bodies that you have. Because the Raps, you know, just the way they've been drafting, they've you know, they have a lot of those types of assets.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing that a team like we said, was in an Eastern Conference final and won two games off the eventual champs last year, have as many young players as they do. They're kind of in a dual mode where they're trying to win every night, and they're capable of doing so, but they're also trying to get young players minutes and develop young players because they have a 9th overall pick in last year's draft on this roster. He was a DNP CD yesterday, but he's played at times this season and looked good. And Jakob Poeltl and Pascal Siakam, their second first-round pick a season ago, he's in the starting lineup. And this is a team that won 56 games a year ago. You don't see that very often, that a team's kind of doing both things and doing them both well, seemingly.
Mm-hmm. Well, Poeltl, like, I know he was drafted ahead of Siakam, but he wasn't as NBA ready as some of the players taken later in the draft. So I think, you know, Masai Ujiri just he can't say enough about the guy's basketball IQ and stuff, but he openly says, like, physically there's still a lot of things he needs to improve on. So the fact that he didn't play Friday, the fact that, you know, he's not getting into the games too much, you know, he hasn't really, you know, impressed every, you know, he hasn't blown the heads off everybody. I don't think that's a big deal right now, because, you know, look at Nogueira. He didn't play very much early in his career, but it took time, and a couple years down the line, he's NBA ready and he's being a productive player in his role. So maybe that's just the type of formula you take with a guy like Poeltl.
Remember preseason, and you don't want to talk about DeMar DeRozan being upset about being ranked in the low 40s by ESPN. A lot of people that rank the Raptors as the third best team in the Eastern Conference, expecting a big step forward by the Boston Celtics, and they've been banged up. Al Horford hasn't played a bunch. I understand that, but they're 4-4. Do you think maybe that those press clippings, although people don't read newspapers anymore, sorry, newspapers, but those clicks, those links, those URLs, really stuck in the craw of some of these Raptors, and they've used that as a piece of motivation because they're 6-2, and they're the Celtics at 4-4, and have looked uneven at times this season.
Yeah, I think it doesn't hurt, because coming into a season in which you were coming off an Eastern Conference Finals showing and getting pretty, you know, though you won two games, you got pretty well outclassed by the Cavaliers. You could have seen a kind of complacency, or, you know, like sort of like fatalism, like, okay, well, what exactly do we have to prove here? You know, what's our motivation heading the season? Obviously, you want to get back, but it's a pretty big slog. And the fact that they got that far without really getting that close in a lot of ways to the championship could have been a sort of a deafening kind of effect. But yeah, no, they've come out really hard. They're playing really well. And I think all that helps. Like, DeMar really seemed to, like, actually take notice of the ranking that they gave him. They definitely seem to be sort of gunning from the beginning. Like, they want to prove that they're better than the Celtics. They don't want some other team just sort of coming and taking their second spot.
Well, and maybe even yesterday was a bit of a statement game, because, as I mentioned, the Hornets were 5-1 headed into that game. Maybe they thought they were this up-and-coming team, a playoff team from a year ago, gave the Heat all they could handle in the first round, that maybe they would be that team that could be the runner-up to the Cavaliers, because I think we all understand that's where the Eastern Conference is headed once again in 2016-2017. And the Raptors took their hope and crushed it over their knee.
Yeah, that's great. And I think they've traditionally, at least this particular core, has traditionally lost to the Hornets and before the Bobcats, because they always overlooked them. You know, like, they just weren't much of a team that you sort of circle on the schedule. But this year, they're looking pretty good. Kemba Walker last night was amazing. They're a team that actually has pieces, and that kind of scares you. They were missing Michael Kidd-Gilchrist, who's an important part of their defense, if not a guy that really jumps off the box score. That's not a team that you're going to overlook anymore. And this team wants to make statements. There's, you know, I think, yeah, like, you can sort of have the nihilism of sort of like, oh, well, who cares? We're second. We're not going to get to first. But now, like, they have something to fight for. Mm-hmm. Like, that second spot is no longer theirs. They had it, you know, with about, like, 30 games left to play last season. They were way up on the third team. So now there they are. They're second, and they have to actually fight for it. And I think that's always good motivating going forward.
And you look at just the way they responded after the third quarter. Like, they allowed 38 points in that third quarter. Yeah. And that was the type of game that, like you said, if they were a team that it's like, all right, well, you know, we're our record's still going to be good if we lose this game. Second place is fine, and then we'll try to get by the Cavs in the playoffs. If that was their attitude, maybe last night's a game. After that third quarter, you pack it in and you just kind of play out the clock kind of thing. That's not what we saw at all. They scored 34 in the fourth. It was a great comeback. Mm-hmm. They were patient. They didn't play panicky. They were very patient. I was watching that game going, why are you passing the ball so much? Take a shot. And, you know, but it worked out. And it's a sign of maturity on this team. They are still a young team, but based on the last few seasons and their playoff runs, it's clear that, you know, they've grown from that, like on and off the court. So last, you know, Friday's game was a great example of, you know, and it maybe it's going to be end up being a metaphor for the type of team this is, that even if, you know, they go down in past seasons, maybe they've packed it in, but this year it's different for whatever reasons.
It's the NBA is tough during the regular season to find, especially if you're a good team. If you're a middling playoff team, if you're just hoping to make the playoffs, every game's super important to you. It's if you're the Raptors, you know you're going to be in the playoffs. You know you're going to be a top four seed and more than likely the second seed in the Eastern Conference. But there are little signposts along the way, and you see most teams really kick it into gear after Christmas, really.
Right.
And up the D and up the intensity. You'd like it to be that way all 82, but it's just not possible generally. But there are little moments throughout the season. And anytime the Raptors play the Cavaliers, you get that, like they did already once at the Air Canada Center in a great game. And Raptors had every opportunity to win that game. Patrick Patterson had a 3-point shot with about 30 seconds to go to tie it up. He missed it, and they lose in another well-fought game. They can beat the Cavs. Last year, they had every opportunity to beat the Warriors twice on the road. Got called on a moving screen that may or may not have been. They had the ball down one with a chance to take the lead. They lost, and the Warriors won 73 games during the regular season, and they were up 3-1 on the Cavs in the NBA Finals. Coming up this week, they go to Cleveland on Tuesday, return home the next day, against the Golden State Warriors. That's always going to be tough, back end of back-to-backs, but you're at home. Early part of the season, when you're looking for things, indicators, goals, when you know you're good, like, is that a two-game stretch where you can really say, ooh, I got that circled, and, you know, this is, it's not the playoffs, and if we lose it, the season's not over. But if we win one, both of those games, that's really saying something.
Yeah, they can be used as a measuring stick, right? Especially the game against the Cavs is if, you know, you take notes in that game and go, okay, we're clearly better than them in these areas, but they're clearly better than us in these areas.
Yeah, the LeBron James area. Yeah, it's tough to be better than them.
They have that area locked down. Yeah. That is a good area for them. But, you know, and you can take a game like these types of benchmark games, you know, marquee matchups, and these are the types of games where you're going to assess what you might need at a trade deadline. It's all right, when we really go up against the elite teams in the league, where do we fall short, and what can we do to, is there anything we can do to improve that?
You know, it's an interesting question, because we're all fatalists, and we all understand the Cavs are winning the Eastern Conference, right? Unless they don't. Do you think the players are like that, though? Do you think that the players, honestly, Craig, DeMar DeRozan, first of all, doesn't believe he's like 46th, whatever, 48th ranked player in the NBA like ESPN thinks he is. These guys, you'd be amazed at some of the things professional athletes believe to motivate themselves, because you have to have a super high confidence. Don't you believe that inside that Raptors dressing room, they not only believe they can beat the Cavaliers, they can win it all?
I think, yeah, like, there's definitely confidence in their ability, but I think
are they realistic?
Somewhere between, like, you know, supremely confident and realistic is where they sit, I imagine. Like, look, they went 6 games against them last year, and so just on, like, if you just take the, that on the face of it, like, look, we were this close, and we were banged up, so, like, let's go. But I think you also look at LeBron James. Everybody in the league looks at LeBron James as the pinnacle player, the guy that is, you know, 1A, 1B, best player in the league, most rounded player in the league. And I think that you have to look at that guy as the guy that you have to beat before you imagine that you're better than him on a regular basis, right?
Well, they beat him twice in that playoff series. They beat him. They beat that team plenty of times during the regular season over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like, I mean, knock off the pedestal because they're currently NBA champions, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, that's a sort of a like an elevated place that you had never gotten to that LeBron has been seven times straight in the past Eastern Conference. Yeah. So yeah, like that guy is, you know, the odds on favorite to make the Eastern Conference final every single year, right? So I think there's a bit of a danger in putting too much of an onus on two regular season games because those tightly packed, like the likelihood of them winning the Warriors game is so low given how well the Warriors are playing right now.
Back into back to backs.
They're traveling in between. I mean, it's not a good situation. That is one you chalk up almost as a sure loss. So if you're sort of trying to measure yourself against that game, you're going to find yourself wanting in ways that you probably aren't. Mm-hmm. So I think you probably focus more on that first game. You try to get a win against Cleveland. Though that does prove difficult, and they do, you're not a perfect matchup for them because they space the floor as well as anybody, and you don't space the floor that well. Also, you saw against the Charlotte Hornets last night, they are really loading up on DeMar. Other teams are mm-hmm. starting to really try to make things as hard as humanly possible. They're just like totally ignoring other players in the offense, and that's not going to work long term, and not going to work as a team mm-hmm. with a team as well put together as the Cavaliers. So,
does the NBA have, we're going to talk about the NFL and its regular season issues and the mushy middle that is every 4-4 team and how, parity is great until it's not, which might be the season, might be the case in the 2016 season in the NFL. This is a topic that comes up every once in a while and usually before Christmas. Does the NBA have a problem with its regular season and the meaningfulness? Because usually you do see the better teams take it easy for the first little bit and then turn it on late in the season and certainly into the playoffs. It's different for the middling playoff teams, like I said, because every game's so important to them because they can miss the playoffs by a game or two, the Pistons and teams like that. They need to win every time out mm-hmm. as often as they can. But for a team like the Raptors, like the Cavaliers, the Warriors, the Spurs, does the NBA still have a problem with the regular season and creating meaningfulness?
I don't know. I think there's enough big personalities and enough sort of household name type guys that you're looking at and going, oh, well, it's, you know, it's DeRozan versus Durant, you know, like two scoring title guys. You know, you got, like LeBron, you know, James Harden, Russell Westbrook. Like there's enough personalities and characters to sort of glom onto. And I think that, something like you brought up the NFL, I think we're lacking in major crossover stars where you can sort of build up, even if they're fake narratives about, you know, oh, rivalries and oh, these guys go way back and stuff like that. Whereas in the NBA, there's a lot of big names and interesting little dynamics that you can create on your own to set up individual games. I don't know, Mike, what do you think?
It's, to me, you know, the NBA is a very top heavy league, and it, to me, it's up to the mid-level teams. It's up to the mid-level, mid-tier, fighting for a playoff spot type teams to make things exciting, you know, because when those teams go up against a LeBron James, you know, a Steph Curry and the elite teams in the game, in theory, the non-playoff teams or the teams fighting for a spot should play their best game. They should be more motivated than if they were playing another 500 team from the other conference or something like that. So, and then in turn, if they put pressure on the stars and the good teams in the East and the West, then the players on those teams will have to play well in a game in order to win the game, you know, or the elite level teams are going to start losing those meaningless, so to speak, games in November and December, and maybe they fall down a few spots in the playoff, in the standings. And then when you start, if you're one of those teams and you start thinking, okay, well, in the second and third round, we might not have a home court advantage, then they start, you know, I think it's, so from an entertaining game standpoint, it's going to end up balancing out. So when you don't have a matchup between two teams featuring a pair of superstars, maybe it's a here's this all-star team against the plucky underdogs that's going to give them a real go kind of thing. So it's up to the lower level teams to make it exciting.
Yeah, and the Raptors have played plenty of exciting games. Yesterday's included in that list as well. When we come back, and I mentioned that the NFL has taken a lot of heat this year. We'll discuss whether that's legit or a media narrative. And it's UFC 205 tonight, and Mikey J is all jacked up about it.
Oh, man.
We'll let him go off on his UFC tangent coming up next. Ben Ennis, Mike Johnson, Craig Battle at Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network.
A taste of what's on Sportsnet.ca right now. Here's Michael Grange.
Kyle Lowry's timing couldn't be better. The Toronto Raptors all-star point guard is coming off a career year on a playoff-bound team and headed for free agency in a summer when every NBA team will be able to push their payroll to $102 million. It's a lot of money to spread around among 15 players, and as a two-time all-star, Lowry can rightly expect to get a lot of it. Like maybe as much as $35 million a year. But on the other hand, Kyle Lowry's timing couldn't be worse. He's playing his best basketball in a season in which he's turning 31. By the time he hits free agency, he'll already be considered old or getting there in the unforgiving eyes of the NBA. The list of point guards that play all-star caliber basketball well into their 30s is very short. But Lowry has made a career of bucking long odds, and the Raptors' point guard is determined prove doubters wrong this time, too. For the past two seasons, he's changed everything about how he eats and trains and even sleeps. His goal is to be better next year than he is now and be better again the year after. His goal is to fight back against time.
Fans can find this story and more on Sportsnet.ca. Canada's home for sports news, analysis, videos, and features. As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake Doctor's Orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand.
Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Ben Ennis, Craig Battle, Mike Johnston. The NFL season rolling right along week 10. And we know a few things. We know that the New England Patriots are good. Mm-hmm. I think we probably know that the Cowboys are good at this point. I don't know if we know anybody else is good. And we know the Browns are bad. I think that's it. I think that's all we know. Everybody else is like, undiscernible how good they are, where they rank. I don't know how you guys do power rankings on Sportsnet.ca.
We try to every week.
It seems impossible. I don't know.
And generally, the par for the course with power rankings is no matter who your team is, you imagine that they're like five spots better, right? Like,
sure.
So it's like, you know, the comment section is usually sort of rife with antagonism towards whoever makes them. This year, it's just like there's 20 teams
between. Yeah, what are you going to do?
Yeah, 3 and 5 and 5 and 3. Like, are you really convinced that you're 3 and 5 team is better than the other 3 and 5 team or what have you? It's like there's a mushy middle that is massive in the NFL.
And every league strives for parity, right? Should they be? Like, is this a lesson that parity is not so great?
I think so. I mean, like, we talk about the NBA being a problem because there's only a couple of teams that can win it, but those teams generate storylines and they create villains for everybody else to play, whereas right now it's hard to get up for anything in the NFL.
I think parity is good in the NFL because it makes the playoff races exciting. You know, if the last 3 or 4 weeks of the season, if there's really nothing to play for, there's no motivation to watch unless it's your team, unless your fantasy team is still around. What's disappointing is the number of NFL teams that are just, they're not well-rounded. Like, mm-hmm. it's surprising to me every week that, you know, a team with a good defense can look so terrible on offense, like the Houston Texans. It's or on the flip side, a team like the Atlanta Falcons, the New Orleans Saints, they're so good on offense, and yet they cannot stop their opponent from scoring on pretty much any drive. So it's frustrating. Like, New England, is one of the few well-rounded teams. That's why they win so often, because some weeks they can beat you with their offense, mm-hmm. and other weeks they can just, you know, play better on defense. But and I think that's one reason why a lot of people find this season so frustrating, is because, man, like one drive you can be like, oh wow, what a great drive, fantastic. And then the next drive you go like, how are you a starting quarterback in the NFL? How did you drop that pass? It's just so much inconsistency on so many teams, offense to defense.
Mm-hmm. There is a lot of consistency with the Cleveland Browns, though. Even with all this mushy middle and the parody, they continue to be bad year in, year out.
They're setting franchise records, guys. Yeah. Franchise records are good, I thought, right?
0-10. The team had never done that before.
Yeah, it's an accomplishment.
Which is amazing. Yeah. But I think another problem for this season has been that it just got off to, like, you know, a very fitting metaphor, a bunch of false starts. Like, we had a bunch of storylines to start the season that people got behind. It's like, oh, the Denver Broncos lost both their quarterbacks, but they're actually playing better and their offense looks great. And that's kind of fallen by the wayside. They lost a couple games. Minnesota was in the same boat, almost exactly. It was like, Teddy Bridgewater isn't around, this team's going to suck. And then they didn't. And it was like, wow, 5-0. Mm-hmm. Maybe this team is for real. And they've just fallen off a cliff. We had Carson Wentz taking the Eagles out to an undefeated start, and that went away. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think it's been hard to get behind any one storyline because it feels like they're all just cycling through so fast and disappearing.
Yeah, and then also just aesthetically, just watching the game, sometimes it's very difficult with all the penalty calls, all the reviews. It's a lot of games are slow. So unless it is a shootout, it's tough to watch a good defensive battle because usually it's low scoring, not because of great defense. It's low scoring because of inefficient offense. You know, so that's something fans are not too happy about this season.
Let's talk about something you are happy about.
Oh my gosh, I'm
so happy. 2 minutes here. It's UFC 205. 205 already.
Yeah, 205 already. Yeah, only yesterday it was 105. I have a question for you guys real hardcore fight fans, but you know who Conor McGregor is. He's headlining the card tonight.
It was a guy wearing the white fur coat.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Mink. Yeah. He loves it. Yeah. PETA didn't like that. Yeah.
No.
But what are your thoughts on, because it seems like every press conference now, he causes a scene. He's throwing chairs or Monster Energy drinks across the room, and he's getting fined, and it's all about him. Has that act, you know, that's one reason why he became so popular, because he was so outspoken and really stood out. But has that act worn thin on you guys at all, just as outside observers?
I don't think so.
No,
I don't think it gets reported in the general sort of mainstream media enough that it makes it tiring to anybody outside it. Like, you see bits and pieces, but I think it's generally it's a good thing for UFC, for me, just because he makes headlines.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't disagree more. I think that whole thing, it's not just him though. I think the whole, before any big fight, the first media conference,
it's phony.
It's totally phony baloney. I don't think you would even argue that, right?
No. Like, well, some of it is contrived, I will say. But the thing I find so interesting about Conor McGregor and every time he fights is Saturday night, UFC 205 will be the number one top trending thing in the world, not just in sports. Like, everyone will be talking about it the same way everyone talks about a Super Bowl or a big award show or anything like that. And I find it very fascinating, Conor McGregor, just as a study of an athlete that became world famous, because there aren't many athletes that can relate to a Conor McGregor. He's really he's maybe not as well known worldwide as someone like Cristiano Ronaldo or LeBron James, but he's their peers in the sense that he is just absolutely at the top of his field, the same way Floyd Mayweather was in boxing or is in boxing. From what I'm excited for the fight, and anyone who's gonna watch the event, it's a great card and they're excited about that. But I'm very curious to see what Conor McGregor looks like, because a lot of UFC fighters and UFC champions I've spoken to recently, they've been telling me that he is starting to believe his own hype. And earlier in his career, there was this persona on stage, but then backstage he was humble and he was respectful. And that humble, respectful Conor McGregor has gone away with the more money and the more success that he's accumulated over the past year or two. That's kind of gone. And now his on-stage performance is also his backstage performance. And I really wonder if that's going to affect his performance tonight. But It's a pretty big event, Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, not much of a bigger stage to do it than that. UFC 205 tonight. That's it for Sports and Magazine Live for Craig Battle, Mike Johnson. I'm Ben Ennis. This has been Sports and Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and the Sportsnet Radio Network.